Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'd met Kevin in the morning and then Sir Alex in the afternoon at David Platt's mother-in-law's house. Sir Alex's words were, am I seeing you first or second? And I said, well, I'd met Kevin this morning. He goes, that's me. Then I was meant to be the final piece in the jigsaw. Didn't quite work out like that.
You agree to sign for Newcastle in
Manchester. Can you believe
after
that?
After singing Everything I Do For You and Me and Bex.
And I had my medical there and everything. Yeah, that was taking the piss.
Bastard, you know, goal scorers.
Correct.
Alan, welcome to the Overlap. We're here in the Docklands, if you like, of Newcastle. Just talk to us a little bit of what this city means to you and sort of growing up in this area.
Well, I was born here. As soon as I could walk, my old man chucked a ball at my feet in a Newcastle top, and that was it. I'm no different to any other kid. That's just what happens here. Football means that much to everyone. My dad went to watch Newcastle every single week and loved it as much as anyone else. I did exactly the same with my son. As soon as he could walk, there's a football, there's a Newcastle kit, and he goes to all the games now, home and away, and he's a mad Newcastle fan, just like I am.
What impact does it have on the city, the football? I know everybody up here is absolutely mad in terms of, you know, about football. What impact does it have when the team's down, particularly in the, say, last 10 years, which has been really difficult?
The football club is their life. They go to work all week, Monday to Friday, 7 till 5 or 7 till 6 to earn money to spend on a weekend, to have a good time. And spending their money means going to watch their club, Newcastle, going to the pubs and restaurants on a Saturday night, then they start all over again. So Newcastle is their life. I mean, I've been all over the country and I've not quite seen anywhere that when you walk around the town, you see the nanas and grandads, the mams and dads, the brothers and sisters, all the kids wearing the black and white, wearing the shirt. So it is their life. So for the last 14 years, it's been really difficult because they've had no hope. Cup competitions have been zero and it's just been about surviving. So I can sort of understand and get why all of a sudden there's a little bit of excitement in the city.
Your dad grew up as a sheet metal worker. What sort of life did you have growing up?
I lived in a three-bedroom council house on an estate. We had the flats opposite where I used to go and kick a ball against the walls and get a bollocking every now and again to keep the noise down. They gave me what they had, which wasn't a lot. They went out and worked extremely hard. My dad worked in the factories. He used to come in at 5 o'clock. His tea was ready for him on the table. Probably still is, actually. And then they gave me the boots. They gave me whatever. They paid for the travel. And if it wasn't for them, I would never have been in the position I am now because, I owe everything to them.
What sort of advice would they give you as a sort of youngster in terms of football, but generally around life?
They would just tell me to do what I wanted to do, so long as I worked hard.
Yeah.
They didn't push me, they didn't force me. They just wanted me to go out and give it a right good go. And I'm like that now with my kids. If I didn't make it, it wouldn't have mattered, but they supported and pushed me all the way as much as they could. And I know if it hadn't worked, then that wouldn't have been a problem for them.
You look at sort of, you know, growing up in Newcastle, how difficult was it when you sort of got to 15?
Yeah, that was the hard part.
Because, and you've got to leave here.
Well, that was really difficult. I had a decision to make. I signed schoolboy forms at 14, which it was what it was then. And then I got offered the apprenticeship to go down to Southampton and leave everything behind, leave Newcastle behind, leave my mum and dad, leave all my pals. And I still remember getting on the train and I could see my mum standing on the side when the train's pulling away and the tears were coming down her face. Like a 15-year-old, 15 is a young age, especially when I've got kids now. I look back and think, God, I'm not sure I could have let my kids go all that way at that age, but it was the best thing I ever did because it got me away from the council estate. It got me away from one or two of my pals who were starting to lead me down a different direction. I learned the game, basically, and I went into a dressing room that was really tough, but it was the best thing I ever did, and starting the old YTS apprenticeship. And it was tough at the time, but it was amazing.
how does Alan Shearer not get spotted around here? You know, you think about the hotbed of football, Newcastle, even, and God forbid, Sunderland or other clubs that are around here. Why would you not have been...
I went to West Brom on trial. I went to Manchester City on trial. I went to Newcastle on trial. And I felt as if they were OK. And I got one or two offers. Newcastle offered me also. But I looked at Southampton and I looked at their youth setup, the players over the years before me who had come through that system. And I thought, you know what? If I'm going to be given a chance, I'm probably going to get one there. Mm. I have a bigger and better chance of going down there. And also, I just felt for me to get out of Newcastle and go and learn football and grow up. And as I said, I think that was probably one of the best decisions I ever made.
Everybody up here has got a passion for Newcastle United that lives in this city.
Yep.
Why does the club not just hone in? Because they want that connection so much between the fans and the players. I can see that when I come up here and saw it for the last 25 years, and I'm not from Newcastle. Why does it not have that incredible sort of youth conveyor belt? Why is it not really honing all the players and the talent up here and the passion and build from that? What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, it needs investment. The academy needs investment. You know as well as I do that you don't get anything without putting something in there. And for the last 14 years, it's had nothing. I mean, the training ground and the academy is exactly how it was when I left back in 2006.
Nothing been spent at all?
Nothing at all. It's the same academy, same training ground. It might add a lick of paint, but other than that, it's nothing. And when you look at the players that have come out of the North East, whether that's Peter Beardsley, Steve Bruce, Michael Carrick, Alan Thompson, Steve Watson, Lee Clark, all of these guys and many guys before that, it's incredible because going forward, whatever happens, that has to change because there's far too much talent that has gone from this area, gone and signed for other clubs, and that has to change, and I'm hopeful that it will.
Is it an investment in the training ground or is it the investment in the scouting, the recruitment, the quality of the coaching?
Everything. It has to be everything. It has to be an investment in Newcastle's training ground, Newcastle's academy, in the scouting, in the coaching. It has to do everything because without all that, then players are still going to go to other football clubs.
In terms of yourself, obviously there's been a lot of talk in the last few weeks about you being reintroduced into the club. Could it be that that type of area of the club is something that you could look at and just completely overhaul? Is that a project that you would look at? I mean, there's been talk about an ambassador, but is it not a focus on the youth and the academy and the actual young people of Newcastle that needs to be sort of the...
Well, that's all it has been at the minute, is talk, Gary, because they've got far more important and bigger decisions to make than who they're going to bring in as ambassador or who they're going to bring into the games. If they want to sit down and talk, then of course I'll be willing to do that. But at the minute, there hasn't been anything, and I wouldn't expect there to be anything.
We're experiencing it at United at this moment in time where you've got a lot of ex-players that are in positions at the club, the manager, coaching staff, technical directors, ambassadors. Mm-hmm. It works successfully, say, at a club like Ajax, where Ajax runs right the way through the club. Is that something that this new ownership, you think, can put into Newcastle? Not for the sake of it, you have to have the right skill sets, but the idea that up here, it is a little bit like a Bilbao, you know, where everything feels very much connected to the people, the fans. That's not to say you won't bring in players from, say, you know, different parts of the country or overseas, but there is a real connection between the ownership, the fans, the players. Do you think that's a way forward for Newcastle?
I do, in certain aspects, because whenever I sit and watch the matches on the TV, I always see former players sat in the stands or sat in the director's box, whether that's promoting the youth, whether that's just bringing in people from different parts of the country. I always feel there is a place for ex-players. Every other football club does it other than Newcastle. We know the reasons why it hasn't happened over the past few years. But again, I would be pretty hopeful that you would see that start to change. I know there was a few ex-players at the Tottenham game, which was great to see. Because there are players not only in this country, but in Europe, who have been successful here. All right, they might not have won anything, but in terms of who they are and what they are and what they could bring to the football club, I would think there's something for the football club to look at there.
Why would Mike Ashley, a smart businessman, made billions of pounds in his sort of private businesses, why would he not do that most simple thing? It's the most simple thing in the last 15 years.
Well, I think it is.
Just to sort of, what would be, if you like, connect with local people, whether that be ex-players, fans. How could he not have done that? Why would he not have done that?
You tell me. I mean, because I think it's pretty simple. I would think it would be very simple to get on the phone to an ex-player to say, oh, come and try and do this, or mix with him, or go and meet these guys for the benefit of the football club, to promote them, to push them forward. I haven't got a clue. Your guess is as good as mine.
we've seen the scenes in the last few weeks. There's great excitement, enjoyment. Is that something that you share as well?
Oh, yeah, I do, absolutely. I'm a fan, you know. I want the football club to challenge. I want them to be bigger and better. I want to have a little bit of hope, and that's exactly why there's so many people that are happy, because Newcastle has flatlined for the last 14 years. As I said, there's been no hope, there's been no excitement, there's been nothing to look forward to. And you think about Newcastle United, last season, they couldn't give 10,000 tickets away. No one wanted them. And that was the situation that Newcastle were in. So go back to where they were in terms of the owners coming in. The ground was buzzing again, there was an excitement there, because that's what's gone on in the past. Now they can look forward. And I just think they would have been happy, whoever came in, if they had to give them a little bit of hope. It just so happens that the people that have come in are incredibly wealthy. But it's 14 years that have gone. They now can look forward and have that excitement again.
You're a Newcastle man. What would you say Newcastle's values and principles are? Not in the last 14 years, but generally as a club.
Hard work, entertain. That's why when you come up here, everyone who's involved with football and the football club, we'll mention the likes of the entertainers or Kevin Keegan, because he gave everyone a little bit of hope. He gave everyone the football that they wanted. Some of the players that he brought in, not only from this country, but from abroad, because I often hear it's difficult to get players to come up and play in Newcastle. Well, they're a huge football club, and you're almost guaranteed 52,000 every single week, and bigger if they could extend the ground, if you give them that little bit of hope.
We're at a Bryan Adams concert. We're singing Summer of 96 together. That night is the night you went to meet Kevin Keegan.
I met Kevin in Manchester. I just thought, you know what? I'm going to go back home. I'm going to come back to Newcastle. I can't let this opportunity go.
How would you describe Mike Ashley's reign at Newcastle United?
Disastrous. Disastrous. Flat. No hope, no excitement. I couldn't describe it in any other words.
You mentioned before the principles of Newcastle, hard work, entertaining, but also when I come up here, the people are straight.
Yep.
They're honest. How would you describe Mike Ashley?
I don't think he should ever have got involved in the football club. I don't know why he did. He may have made a lot of money. I haven't got a clue. I don't really want to. It's got nothing to do with me anymore. But he's an incredibly successful businessman, and no one can knock him for that in whatever way he wants to do it. But I don't think him or his people sort of understood football or what he was getting into.
Did he lose the fans at the point where that end of that season where he didn't make you the manager for the following season, even though he promised you the job? Was that the point where you think it turned for you then, I suspect, did it, in terms of just the integrity of how it happened?
I don't think that was the point. I mean, that was hugely disappointing for me, because I thought I was going to go on and do that. I'd left a lot behind in terms of leaving the BBC to do what I was doing. I mean, I loved doing that. But I felt at the end of the eight games, although what happened, it was a disaster. But it wasn't for the want of trying or hard work. I knew that we'd all given everything, but I did want the chance to try and bring Newcastle back up. And then it didn't happen. And then after a year or two, I thought, you know what, it's never going to happen. I've got to then concentrate on the media side of things. But I don't think he lost it then. I just think over time, when you look at what could have happened, what he could have done, and no one wanted him to do what Manchester City were doing, or Chelsea were doing, or Man United were doing, and spending the hundreds of millions of pounds to go and demand a Premier League. They just wanted a club that tried, that wanted to achieve something rather than just trying to avoid relegation all the time.
In terms of sort of now, what do the owners of Newcastle United Football Club need to do? Obviously, we're here now in this bit of land where the Shepherd family own this piece of land. They were successful owners of Newcastle United. They're connected with the fans, they know the local area.
Yeah.
What do this ownership, who are not connected to the local area, need to do to connect to the Newcastle fans?
What they must understand is that these people, as I said, I keep going back to that core of people working extremely hard all week to go and support their club. They will travel all over the world. They will buy whatever they want them to buy, so long as they give that little bit of hope, that little bit of excitement and something to look forward to.
Al, so we're at a Bryan Adams concert
in
1996, post European Championships. Yeah. I've just put that little crossing on your head. I'm thinking, really, feeling really confident. You're just about to leave Blackburn. Yeah. We're singing Summer of 96 together. Your agent's there. Bex is there in the box with us. And lo and behold, that night is the night you went to meet Kevin Keegan. Is
I
that
did,
right?
Absolutely. But it was a great cross, by the way. yeah, it was. I met Kevin before the concert.
In Huddersfield?
In Huddersfield, yeah. And things were great. But I was still undecided then because such a big decision. I mean, Man United, as you know, huge football club, manager. We don't have to talk about him because I know how big he is. And at one stage, I'd made a decision. I'd gone home and said, I'm going to go to Man United. We'd even sort of had a drive around Manchester and we were going to buy Graeme Souness's house on Mayor.
Right.
Not so long after that concert that we were both at, I got another call off Kevin to say, can I have another half an hour with you? And I did. And I just thought, you know what? I'm going to go back home. I'm going to come back to Newcastle. I can't let this opportunity go.
What was the sequence of events? So Sir Alex had met you when? Just before that concert, earlier on that day?
I'd met them both after that again, believe it or not, at David Platt's mother-in-law's house.
Right.
Somewhere in Chester, I think it was. I'd met Kevin in the morning and then Sir Alex in the afternoon. And Sir Alex's words were, am I seeing you first or second? And I said, well, I'd met Kevin this morning. He goes, that's me, then. It wasn't as straightforward as that. It was a really, really tough decision, but I mean, this place, as you know, I grew up here. I came and stood on the Gallagher end there and watched my hero, Kevin Keegan, and every single week I used to come and watch, and I thought, I've got to go home. And they were willing to pay a world record fee for me. And it wasn't as if I was coming to a club that was struggling. I mean, the season before, they'd just blown that 12-point lead, I think it was, against you lot. And then I was meant to be the final piece in the jigsaw. Didn't quite work out like that.
In terms of, obviously, I played under Kevin with England for sort of a couple of years, and his enthusiasm, was it that or was it the Newcastle, or was it both?
No, I mean, it wasn't. I didn't sign for Kevin. I know Kevin was the manager. I mean, Kevin was brilliant at selling Newcastle United, but he didn't have to me because I knew what it was. Everyone knew what Newcastle United meant to me. It was a good job I didn't sign for him because he was only here 6 months. I'd signed in the July or August. And then Kevin sort of left it at Christmas. So it was a good job I didn't really sign for him. It was the football club that I signed for, and I just wanted to be a part of it, and I wanted to play here. I had to play here.
What was the point where you said, right, I'm going back? Was there a discussion? Was there a conversation with your wife?
I met Kevin, believe it or not, in Manchester.
That's taking the piss, isn't it?
I know, yeah. He was flying out to the Far East on a pre-season trip, and he said, can I come and see you? And the team have gone, and he was going to get on a flight separately. So I went to meet him. That was the decision then. And I never, ever went back home. I rang home. I said, you're going to have to pack a bag for me. I've made my decision. Send a bag through to the airport, put it in a cab. And I never, ever went back to that house.
So you agreed to sign for Newcastle
in Manchester. Can you believe that?
After singing Everything I Do For You and Me and Bex.
And I had my medical there and everything. Yeah, that was taking the piss. Yeah. But I had to then ring Sir Alex.
How was that?
I've spoken to him in terms of him wanting to sign me for Man United. I thought the decent thing is to ring him now. So I rang him on the way to the airport. No
Hello.
Answer. I rang him again. No answer. So I thought he's definitely not taking my call. So I thought I had to leave
him
a message.
Had he been told then?
I think he'd already been told. Yeah.
By your agent?
I don't know who had told him, but I think he was aware of the situation. And not surprisingly, he didn't want to take my call.
You had dinner with him, lunch with him a few weeks ago. Yeah. What was he saying about it?
He always reminds me whenever I see him about turning Man United down twice. I said, it wasn't twice, it was only once. It was the time in 96. I couldn't have signed in 92 when I was leaving Southampton to go to Blackburn. And he always reminds me how many trophies I would have had. And what can I say?
How can it be that difficult for you to have a statue in the right place outside this ground?
Ask Mike. My friend Mike, the late great Sir Bobby came in. I mean, he saved my career and saved this football club.
Hi everyone, I hope you're enjoying this episode. This is just a quick thank you to Skybet, our partners, for making this show happen. It's something I've wanted to do for a long, long time. Please subscribe, there's loads more episodes coming up and I hope you're enjoying it. Right, let's get back into this episode. You scored an unbelievable amount of goals here, unbelievable career, but there were ups and downs. Just talk to us generally about how you describe your Newcastle career, and was it everything that you wished for and hoped for?
It was everything and more. My first goal was down at that end. It was the Leasers end it was. against Wimbledon. I mean, amazing. I mean, can you imagine? I grew up here. I wanted to play for this football club, to have 10 years here, to have the record number of goals, to have a statue, and to have the relationship with the fans and the football club that I have. I mean, I wouldn't change a thing. Despite the trophies, I know I would have had a shed load of more trophies, but despite all of that, it was an amazing 10 years here, and I wouldn't change anything for the world.
You mentioned the statue. How can it be that difficult for you to have a statue in the right place outside this ground?
Yeah, it's just outside, albeit it's only about 10 yards outside. I mean, I've got to thank the Shepherd family for that, because they were the ones that funded it, along with the council, and putting it where it is.
It's not on the actual club's designated
boundaries.
It's
not on the club's grounds. It's about 10 yards outside at the club, for whatever reason. Ask Mike. My friend Mike, asked Mike why he wouldn't, or Lee Charnley, why they wouldn't allow it inside the ground.
It just staggers me. And then there's another story about the bar named after you, and then they changed the name of the bar.
Yeah, there was a bar at that end, Gallagher End, was named after me, but soon after, when Mike came in, that went to number 9 bar, and not Shearer's anymore. It wasn't my bar, it was just in my name. I never got any proceeds from it, unfortunately.
Do you think that'll turn back now? You think we'll see the Shearer's bar return?
I don't know, maybe that's one of the things the new owners might do. I know they spoke about moving the statue, which is obviously very, very kind, so we'll see what happens.
Just take us through some of the managers you played under here, great managers, you know, Sir Bobby Robson. What was it like to play Champions League football, Sir Bobby Robson, here?
Well, we started off with Kevin, and of course, and
how did it end with Kevin? Just, I mean, because obviously I was with England. When I look back now, and I think it was one of the most bizarre endings of a managerial career. But actually, I respect him enormously, because I always thought, to be fair, he just thought, no, it's not for me. I've done enough. I've taken it as far as I can. It takes a lot to do that, doesn't it?
He was a heart on his sleeve, Kevin, isn't he? Very, very emotional, very, very passionate. And I still don't know the full reasons as to why Kevin left here when he did. I would imagine it was him taking the club to somewhere different to where the owners wanted to go. I had Kenny at Blackburn, and I thought he would have been tailor-made for this place. Didn't quite work out for him. Then, of course, we had Rude, which I knew from sort of day one that I wasn't going to get on with Rude when he was a manager. I mean, we get on great now.
I know, obviously, I've seen you working together.
Yeah, we get on great now.
He's brilliant to work with. Why wouldn't you get on? Just because of he's a young manager, you're an experienced player. What was the tension? What was the problem?
Well, his words, not mine, when we did sit down and talk about it, he was young, he knew he was Dutch, and he was arrogant. And that was his words, not mine. And that was the way it was, actually. I mean, he came in and we had a really experienced dressing room. We had John Barnes, Stuart Pearce. We had myself, we had Rob Lee, Ian Rush, I think, might have been here at the time. Really experienced players, and he didn't want anything to do with any senior players, and sort of wanted to push everyone to one side, which I just found bizarre, because you could just lean on their experience and use those players to guide you through the early periods, but he didn't want anything to do with it, and come in and sort of wanted to pick a fight with that, which I thought was just a disaster. And then the late, great Sir Bobby came in. I mean, he saved my career here at Newcastle and saved this football club, because it was going down. We were going to be relegated. When you consider when he came in, we were in the bottom three, couldn't beat anyone. Went to Chelsea in his first game, put up a really good performance, were beaten unfortunately. But in his first game here against Sheffield Wednesday, I think we just put 8 past them. He got all the senior players into his office. This is what he wants to do. This is how he's going to treat everyone. Sort of got everyone smiling again, so much energy back into the football club, not inside the dressing room, but also in this stadium. And then we scored 8. So from where he took us at the bottom of the league to Champions League football, I mean, it was just some of the nights we had in the Champions League were just phenomenal. And he was a genius as a manager, how he got the best out of young players and experienced players. I mean, whether you were on 5 grand a week as a youngster, or whether you were on 50 grand a week as a plus 30-year-old, he knew how to handle you, knew how to get the best out of you, and he was the very, very best at that.
Was he tough with players?
Was he? I mean, he could turn the dressing room blue. There's no doubt. Yeah. No, absolutely, yeah. He could come in and some of the rows that we had in the dressing room. But what he was brilliant at, is come Sunday or Monday morning, it was all forgotten about, and he was come back in and the arm round you again, and then because he had to get you to play for him again. So he didn't mind telling you what he thought in the dressing room, absolutely.
And in terms of his football style, what was his football style in terms of what, how, when he came to you and said, this is what I want from you, what did he want from
you? He wanted you to go and express yourself. He wanted you to go and entertain, but he just wanted you to give your all. That's the type of a manager. If you give everything for him, he would look after you. Very much, I think, like Sir Alex did. I mean, if you go out and you battle for your manager, they'll protect you to the hilt, and Sir Bobby was like that.
Which of the managers that you played under do you feel influences your view of football most?
I look at Kenny. We had Kenny at Blackburn for the 3 or 4 years that he was there. And again, as a man manager, wanting to play for him, wanting to go and break your neck for him on a football pitch. And I look at managers like that and I think, you know what, I'm going to go out and I'm just going to give that extra hard yard that you want us to do. Kenny was brilliant at that. Terry Venables was amazing at that, as you know. Yeah. Great man manager and also a great coach on some of the sessions that he put on and what he wanted you to do on a football pitch in terms of setting targets, whether you're closing someone down or the shape that you were playing, and he was superb at that, but also protecting you. Mm. And Sir Bobby, he was, as I said, in terms of a man manager, Bobby, he was an absolute genius at that. And when you consider some of the criticism that he had to put up with being an England manager to where he got to, and I was absolutely delighted that he came in to this football club, his area, and was able to do what he did. I think, well, I know it meant so much to him and to his family.
Was the success of Sir Bobby Robson his experience, his likability, his quality, or was it because as well that important bit around he understood the area, he understood Newcastle?
I think it was a bit of both, but certainly he knew the area, he knew what the people demanded and wanted and hoped. And he spoke a great game, and he was just so passionate about football. I mean, he could sit with you for days on end and talk about systems and football, what he'd achieved in the game. I mean, when you look at the success that he had all around the world, when he spoke, you listened.
This club just let go of Steve Bruce. It was a brutal ending.
I didn't want him to take it. I was told I was going to be the manager. 2 or 3 days later, I got a call to say there's an issue with the bank. We'll be in touch. And it's 2021, I'm still waiting for the call.
Did you want to be manager of Newcastle United?
I did after those 8 games. I always wanted to go into management. I always thought I was going to go into management. So when the opportunity came along, probably a little bit earlier than I had anticipated, I couldn't turn it down. I couldn't. I mean, I was the fourth manager that season when Newcastle came knocking on my door with 8 games left. So I had to take it. And despite what happened at the end of it, I thought I was going to be the manager, and I was told I was going to be the manager. I shook hands. I was going to be the manager with Mike at the end of the season. And then 2 or 3 days later, I got a call to say there's an issue with the bank. We'll be in touch. And it's 2021 and I'm still waiting for the call. That's not going to happen.
And in terms of managerial, like, now?
Never. Gone. No, that's gone. It's gone. I think you're outside of the game now and you're looking on in. And the longer you're out of the game, the harder it is to get back in. But I had the 8 games, I loved it, I thought I was going to go into it, but management's not for me now.
This club's just let go a manager, that Steve Bruce, it's a brutal ending.
We've both
witnessed it in the last sort of what would be 6 to 12 months. What was your feeling? I mean, because obviously you knew Steve as well, so you were torn between the fans, you're torn between obviously your dislike quite clearly for the owner of the time, but also a good man and a friend of yours in Steve Bruce.
I'm a good pal of Steve's, him and his family, and it hurt me a lot to see what they had to go through. And football's brutal, as you know. And Steve's big enough and honest enough to tell you that when you're not getting results, you're going to have to take the flak. So when that happens, you're going to get hammered, whether you like it or not. And when you go into that position as manager, you have to accept that you're going to have to take that on the chin. In terms of the last 2 years, from what he had in terms of on the pitch to where they got to in a league position, I think it punched above their weight. So in the ending, I felt for him, but it was the reason why I said to him I didn't want him to take it, because I was aware of...
You didn't take this job?
I didn't want him to take it, no, because I was aware of what the feeling was. I know how difficult a football club it was to manage. Yeah. He took on an almost an impossible situation because of what the fans wanted, what the owner was, and in terms of putting into the football club. It was almost an impossible job for Steve after coming in and trying to follow Rafa, because I was aware of what Rafa meant to the people here and how he communicated what he wanted. He was very clever, Rafa, in terms of what he did. He did a good job, but he was also very clever in what he did in terms of talking about the owner.
How did he talk about the owner? Because it's one of the things I don't come up with. I don't know this area anywhere near as much as you. But the perception of what Rafa did here and the perception of what Steve Bruce did here is absolutely just...
Well, when you look in terms of league positions, there's very little. They're almost identical. Points for, goals against. There wasn't a great deal in it, but what Rafa was brilliant at was getting the fans on side in terms of dropping little hints, dropping little bombs into the to media about what's going on inside the football club, what he was maybe wanting to do and couldn't do. But Steve, I don't think, did as well as that in getting his point across, and probably couldn't because he was the owner's appointment. So he appreciated that. And so he sort of had to keep them on side in terms of not saying anything against him. I understood that. I got that. But I also know the problems and the issues that he had in wanting to do, bring players in and wasn't able to do that.
What is the structure here of recruitment behind the scenes in what's in place here? What have the new owners picked up?
Well, I hope they would have picked up in terms of the recruitment that they've had and some of the money that has been spent. Nowhere near enough, but when they've gone out, I mean, you try and work out £40 million for Joe Linton. I mean, how do you work that out? And I actually feel sorry for Joe Linton at times because he was given the number 9 shirt. He was asked to play centre forward. He was asked to go and score goals. None of that is his fault. That's not his position. Could never criticise his work rate in terms of what he does, what he tries. He never hides away, but he's not a goal scorer, he's not a number 9 and he's not a centre forward, yet he was asked to do all that. How do you work that out?
But Mike Ashley wouldn't have been making that decision, would he?
I wouldn't have thought so. I wouldn't have thought so. And that's one deal I've never really been able to look at and explain, and I don't think many people will be able to. So in terms of the new owners coming in charge of who's in charge of recruitment, and that's what I'm saying. There's so many big decisions to be made here at this football club. But do they want a sporting director or a director of football, or a chief executive? Who's going to run the actual football club? So there's so many important, big decisions to be made because we said earlier, they are in a relegation battle.
In terms of the ownership, there are 3 owners. There is 2 10% shareholders, the Rubin brothers, I think it is.
Yep.
Amanda Staveley and her husband, and obviously the PIF, the investment fund from Saudi Arabia.
Yep.
Obviously, 80% shareholder can make the final decision, but who is the sort of decision maker here?
Well, at the moment, it certainly looks like Amanda and her husband, but I guess because of those percentages, what you've just mentioned, they've got 80%, the PIF, so I would imagine it's those guys that sign everything off, and you've got to get answers from them before any big decisions can be made.
I think once you accept Russian, Chinese, Abu Dhabi money into this country in football clubs, you can't then just say, OK, we're going to stop with Saudi Arabia. What do you expect from the new owners in terms of their communication, their adaptation to the area, the connection to the club, and are you comfortable with it? Do you want to hear more from them, see more from them? They are disconnecting it a little bit in terms of the PIF and the Saudi Arabian sort of state, but there are some things that all happen over in Saudi Arabia which just cannot happen in the sort of normal world. Where does that sit with you in terms of Alan Shearer, local Newcastle fan?
I was as excited as any other fan here because of one, they got rid of the previous regime because there was no hope or excitement. So that's one thing. The owners have now come in and we can look forward as a football club to hopefully to bigger and better things and have that little bit of hope, albeit everyone's going to have a lot of patience because it's not going to happen overnight. But I also think it's right that big questions are asked and are, because more questions have been asked in the last 2 or 3 weeks than ever asked before. And I know things that have gone on in Saudi Arabia and outside of it that are totally unacceptable. But the more questions they ask, that's going to be the better. And I think the people here sort of understand that. But it's also our job is to educate ourselves. It was only a matter of time, I think, before the Saudi Arabians were going to be allowed into the Premier League because, as you say, the Russians, Chinese, Americans, all these countries are now inside the Premier League. But it's right that those questions are asked and also get answers. But because I think the communications coming out of this football club, we've had more in the last 2 weeks than we've ever had in the previous 14 years. But in terms of that side of things, also, absolutely, you have to answer those questions as well.
But how have you handled post-football career?
Tough, yeah, it's tough. Really, really difficult. Where'd you get that buzz from?
You hold the record for the most penalties scored in the Premier League. Can you remember the 4 that you missed? The bastards, you know, goal scorers.
Correct.
Al, so every guest on the Overlap gets asked a question around failure is a bruise, not a tattoo. It was a saying that was sent to me off the back of being at Valencia. Obviously a massive failure, but doesn't last forever. What moment in your life do you feel was your absolute low, couldn't get any worse, and you've gone home and you don't know what to do?
When I broke my ankle I had three serious injuries. The first one was I ruptured my cruciate ligament when I was at Blackburn. That wasn't too bad because I was young, still fresh, still energetic, knew I would sort of get over it. But when I broke my ankle, I broke it in a pre-season, a year after I'd signed here, I just thought, oh God, and it was such a bad break as well because I displaced my ankle joint, broke my ankle, broke my fib, and it was so hard, the rehab. Mm. Whereas the rehab for the 6 or 7 months when I did my cruciate, it wasn't too bad because, as I said, I was young and I'd still had a few scars after that. But at 27, 28, to get over serious injuries, that was when I was probably at my lowest, yeah.
So when I ever watched you play or played against you or even played with you, I always thought that you were just like brick mentality, just solid as a rock. Mm. But were there ever moments where, did you ever see a psychologist as a football player? Did you ever?
No, I'd never, not that side of things. I think I go back to my parents bring me up in the way they did. And I think it was just, you know, kicking a ball out on a street and going out with your pals and where I was from. You had to be sort of tough to survive, and if you weren't, then you didn't really make it. And going away at 15 was tough, but it's not as if I could just get on a train and come back home for a weekend because it was that far away. You just had to learn to deal with things. But that injury was really tough, and I think it was sort of after that I realised that I had to change my game because I'd lost half a yard of pace, and I knew that, but I never ever wanted to say that. What I didn't lose was that knack to being at the right place at the right time. I was still able to score 20 or 25 goals a season, but I knew I had to sort of change my game slightly, and I was able to do that, fortunately.
How have you handled post-football career? Obviously, we see you on the television, but how have you handled post-football career in terms of just the loss of adrenaline, the loss of the everyday structure? Has that been difficult?
Tough, yeah. It's really, really difficult. It's not until you really finish that that's the end. I mean, you go in, everything's structured. You wake up, take the kids to school, go into training, train, go back home, rest, get ready, prepare for the Saturday or the Wednesday, and you've done that for 18 or 20 years. And then all of a sudden, one day, boom, that's it, finished, off. And then the club really don't want anything to do with you anymore. Yeah. That's it, you've gone. And then all of a sudden, where do you get that buzz from? Where do you get that adrenaline rush from? Because walking out of this tunnel here or scoring a goal at the Gallagher end, there is no better feeling in the world. And then all of a sudden, gone, finished. It's hard to deal with. I was lucky because I sort of left one dressing room and gone into another one in terms of the Match of the Day studio with Alan Hansen or Ian Wright or whoever that may be. So you still get a bit of crack in the room that we sit all day on a Saturday and watch the games. We still get that dressing room laughing a joke, if you like. So I was one of the lucky ones, but it was still difficult. But I know guys that hit rock bottom and still do because of the difficulty it is. They go chasing the buzz, and you got to realise that. That buzz is not longer there anymore.
Al, every guest on The Overlap does a challenge, and we've got a little quiz for you. 9 quiz questions, and we'll see how many you get right. You are top goal scorer in Premier League history, but how many of your 260 Premier League goals were scored with your right foot?
More
or less than 200?
Less.
Correct. 194.
Should have asked me. I told you.
No. How many of your 260 Premier League goals were scored with your head? More or less than 40?
More, just.
You got the number?
46, is it? 46, yes. 47? Spot on.
You know everything about every goal, don't you? You can name them, couldn't you? The bastard, you know, goal scorers.
Correct.
You hold the record for the most penalties scored in the Premier League at 56, but can you remember the 4 that you missed?
I don't remember the chances that I missed. That's a stupid question. I only remember the goals. The ones I missed, I remember missing one against Sunderland, which was a killer.
Have we not got that? Is it Premier League? Premier League penalties, we haven't got that one.
We missed about 8.
Who scored more game-winning Premier League goals, yourself or Sergio Aguero?
Aguero.
It is you, 68 and 4. Whoever's put these questions, there better be one that he loses. Can't give him a win in everyone. Who scored more left-footed goals, yourself or Thierry Henry?
I would have to say Thierry. I mean, I got a few, but not that many. Thierry.
Yeah, you were 20, he was 31. Which goalkeeper did you score more Premier League goals against, Ian Walker or Nigel Martin?
I would have to say Nigel Martin. I just remember Leeds was my favourite team. Was it Nigel Martin?
Yeah, it was Nigel Martin.
Yeah, sorry, Nigel.
How many league goals did you score in the 90th minute or later? Tough one, that.
90th minute, I don't know, 10.
8.
What was it? Good guess.
How many of your league goals came from inside the box?
Inside the box. 2-8, 2-8.
227.
Oh, okay.
And finally, you played 15 matches in a league game against me. How many goals did you score against the back line that I was in?
Oh, loads. How many league goals?
That's bad, that.
14 games, did you say?
15 matches.
15 matches, so it would have been 9 or 10.
6.
Was it
all? Not that bad.
All right.
I was all right. Yeah. Al, brilliant. Well
Thanks
done.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Great
well done. Thank you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.